and have their own kids. His fears are those of his fellow aging baby boomers, including the fear of memory loss from Alzheimer's disease or dementia. In the United States alone, 5 million people over the age of 65 suffer from dementia in one form or another. That he'd lose the ability to write because of mental incapacitation is King's greatest fear. For him, it'd be the equivalent of a debilitating stroke for an artist, the kind suffered by the late Frank Frazetta, an athletic, healthy man for most of his life, who was forced in his last few years to learn how to draw with his left hand after losing control of his right. Not surprisingly, King's thoughts of death and the afterlife are increasingly the subjects of his fiction. It's one reason why King is driven to write. He knows that at his age, he doesn't have time to waste. In On Writing, Scribner 2000, he expressed his exasperation of fellow writers who publish infrequently. "I always wonder two things about these folks. How long did it take them to write the books they did write, and what did they do the rest of their time? If God gives you something you can do, why in God's name wouldn't you do it?" I am reminded of what King wrote many years ago, in an essay for Fear Itself, which still holds true today. "But the writer's job is to write. And there are no brand names in the little room where the typewriter or the pen and notebook sit waiting. There are no stars or brand names in that place. Only people who will try to create something out of nothing. And those who succeed and those who fail. It's not a bad life. It's a writer's life. It's Stephen King's life. And he wouldn't have it any other way." The Bonus Round and Gallows Humor. An interview by Katie Couric, Dateline, November 1st, 1999. In the King household, the phrase, "the bonus round," is a reference to Stephen's life after the accident. It was inspired by the TV show Wheel of Fortune and its bonus round puzzle. Stephen King: "I never shut up. I was thinking, I'd like to have an open-viewing coffin with a pole ring so I could actually pre-record things like, 'Aren't I looking natural? Isn't it nice that I didn't suffer?' You know, things like that." Tabitha King: "And I tell him, 'Don't get too excited, you're getting a coffee can. A nice old Maxwell House coffee can.'" Katie Couric: "You are all sick." Stephen King: "We joke about it because we had a close one. Nobody makes you any promises. They're saying you have a good chance to walk again. Look, I'm really delighted not to be a quadriplegic. It's great to be alive, and they don't have to promise anything." The minivan that struck him was bought by the Kings for $1,500 through his attorney, to prevent it from being sold to fans who might try to sell pieces of it as a macabre souvenir on eBay. The minivan was taken to a junkyard, crushed into a square, and likely sold for junk metal. As for Mr. B.S., he died a year later on September 21st, Stephen King's birthday. 81. Hearts in Atlantis, 1999. Stephen King was a BMOC, a big man on campus at the University of Maine at Orno, a baby boomer who graduated in 1970, 3 years before the United States formally ended its involvement in Vietnam. King was an imposing figure at college. A tall man with long black hair and a beard, King manned the ramparts at student rallies and protested the ill-conceived and futile American involvement in the Vietnam War. In one yearbook photo, he's captured in an angry pose, an arm upraised as he angrily rallies students to get involved and denounce the war. As every military veteran says about their experiences during wartime, you had to have been there to know what it was like. But if you were fortunate enough not to have an all-expenses-paid trip to the rice paddies of South Vietnam, count yourself lucky. There's been a lot of books written about the war, but if you read only one, which captured its true essence, read Dispatches by Michael Hare. Stephen King never saw South Vietnam because he flunked his army physical. He had high blood pressure, flat feet, and burst eardrums. But even if he hadn't, he would have qualified for a student deferment. Counting his lucky stars, King sat out the war, but he sure as hell let the establishment know how he felt. He and his fellow college students supported the troops, but not the freaking war. The lottery. Back then, all males 18 and older had to register for the draft. It was a lottery, pure and simple. A spin of the wheel of fortune that, if you were lucky, kept you stateside. The U.S. involvement in South Vietnam ended on March 29, 1973. But the war itself dragged on for another 2 years, and on April 30, 1975, South Vietnam was easily overrun by the North Vietnamese. We knew then that the bitter and bloody war was lost, and it had all been for nothing. Not counting the MIAs, which we're still trying to account for 40 years after the fact, 58,282 body bags came back, and another 303,644 troops came back wounded. Their lives forever changed, and not for the better. Back then, we didn't know enough about post-traumatic stress disorder to effectively treat it. We blew it. That line from Easy Rider, spoken by Captain America, played by Peter Fonda, to Billy, played by Dennis Hopper, encapsulated our involvement in the Vietnam War. Tragically, it was damn true. And for that reason, it became the epigraph to Hearts in Atlantis. Survivor Guilt. In There But For Fortune, a book review of Hearts in Atlantis in the New York Times, Caleb Crane writes, "We now know what Stephen King, the master of horror, is afraid of. In Hearts of Atlantis, King takes up the Vietnam War, and it scares him so bad he won't let his hero act imprudently. Only the book's minor characters enlist and serve. At the last minute, and with a touch of regret, the book's central figure thinks better of flunking out of college in 1966. He stays enrolled, and he stays civilian. This time, instead of horror, King has written something with an emotional strategy much slower and much more diffuse. Hearts in Atlantis is a book about survivor guilt. Teach your children well." King's dedication for Hearts in Atlantis. This is for Joseph and Leonora and Ethan. I told you all that to tell you this. Joseph, Joe Hill, is his firstborn son. Leonora is Hill's ex-wife, and Ethan is their son. In telling the stories, two novellas, two short stories, and an epilogue that compose this book, Stephen King has written a cautionary tale for them and other young people everywhere. Crane, in his lengthy review, calls the book messy. Perhaps, but if it is, it certainly mirrors the nature of the Vietnam War itself, which stands at the dark heart of this lengthy 522-page book. It ends with a brief author's note that includes this illuminating observation. Although it is difficult to believe, the 60s are not fictional. They actually happened. These stories are not so much filtered through the war as they are permeated with it. Thus, the stories serve as much more than cautionary tales. They deserve to be read, and they do what fiction does best. They make us feel human. Coda, Squad D. The stories in Hearts in Atlantis, as far as most of King's readers know, comprise the bulk of his meditations on the Vietnam War and its aftermath. But there's another story, which serves as a coda, that remains unpublished. Squad D. Written for Harlan Ellison's unpublished anthology, tentatively titled Last Dangerous Visions, which was originally scheduled for publication in 1973. Squad D is a short story, but needs work, according to Harlan, who asked Stephen King for a rewrite because he thought there's more in the story than what King delivered. As to when we will see King's story, no one, not even its editor, Harlan Ellison, knows. Last Dangerous Visions remains unpublished. 82. On Writing. A Memoir of the Craft and Secret Windows. Essays and Fiction on the Craft of Writing, 2000. Original title of On Writing, On Fiction. Most of what writers write about their work is ill-informed bullshit. Stephen King, Foreword. The Little Sisters of Illyria. Writer's Block. After the accident, I was totally incapable of writing, King told Katie Couric on Dateline in an interview that aired on November 1, 1999, adding, At first it was as if I'd never done this in my life. It was like starting over again from square one. I mean, from like being 12, 13 years old. There was this one awful minute where I sat there and I thought, I can't do this. I don't know how to do this anymore. I don't know whether it was a confidence thing or whether it was a memory thing. It took about 4 days to actually look at the sentences and see that they still made sense. But I thought if I didn't go back to work, maybe I wouldn't go back to work. Even before Carrie was published in 1974, Stephen King was fielding questions about how to get professionally published. Several of his English students at Hampton Academy asked for his advice, which he gladly gave. In interviews, at public speeches, and in profile pieces, King has generously provided detailed information on the art and craft of writing fiction. But it wasn't until 2000 that he published two books codifying his thoughts on the subject. In the wake of the near-fatal minivan accident, King found himself suffering from writer's block for the first time in many years. At the time of his accident, he was working on Writing. In that book, he wrote, Writing is not life, but I think that sometimes it can be a way back to life. That was something I found out in the summer of 1999, when a man driving a blue van almost killed me. On Writing's subtitle is A Memoir of the Craft. It is organized in four sections. The first, CV, Curriculum Vitae, is an autobiographical overview with an emphasis on his writing efforts. The second, On Writing, explains the nuts and bolts of how to write. The third, On Living, a postscript, brilliantly recounts in detail his near-fatal accident, and last, and furthermore, shows King's editing process at work, using the hotel story as an example. The book ends with a detailed reading list. I've read countless books about editing, writing, and publishing, and if I had to pick just two, I'd recommend, as does King, The Elements of Style by William Strunk Jr. and E.B. White, and for a how-to manual, I'd recommend On Writing for several reasons. 1. It's compulsively readable and entertaining. 2. It gives you a very good sense of what a writer's life is like. 3. The practical section is filled with time-tested advice. 4. The nonfiction essay about King's accident is a brilliant example of how to write. In other words, he first tells you what to do in this book, and then shows you how to do it. 5. He provides an example of his own editing to show you how to tighten and improve the work. 6. He provides a useful reading list. Consider it enjoyable homework. Boiled down to its essence, King's advice is read a lot and write a lot, which is easy to say but a lot harder to implement. Remember, King started writing in his early teens, and even then took his craft very seriously. He learned, at age 12, how to write a professional cover letter, how to properly format a manuscript, and how to deal with editors. King's cinematic style of storytelling developed early, but he honed it to a sharp edge over the years. By the time he submitted Carrie, he was an unpublished novelist, but no novice. 5 books had preceded Carrie, including 2 trunk novels, one of which was eventually published, Blaze, 2007, and 4 Richard Bachman books that were also published, attesting to his early mastery of storytelling skills. If you are interested in publishing fiction professionally or want to give a young aspiring writer a book on the subject as a starting point, On Writing is right on the mark. Secret Windows, Essays in Fiction on the Craft of Writing. Taking its title from a King story, Secret Window, Secret Garden, in Four Past Midnight, this 431-page book from Book of the Month Club is, unfortunately, out of print. BOMC has been absorbed by the Literary Guild, which has not reissued this companion book to On Writing. The book's introduction, by Peter Straub, was done especially for this book, and properly sets the stage for what follows. The book, though, needed a good editor to serve up this collection of fiction and non-fiction pieces, which are haphazardly arranged with no contextual notes. In anthologies, the rule is that you start and end with a big bang. So with this book, I'd put On Becoming a Brand Name as the lead-in piece instead of King's Juvenilia, and end with An Evening with Stephen King instead of a piece of fiction, In the Death Room, which is an odd choice for this collection, and especially odd for its placement as the final piece. Moreover, it's a weak story. King could have written a horrific piece, but instead wrote one that reads more like a badly told joke, with stereotyped characters and an implausible plot hole, through which one could drive a Mack truck. Most of the pieces are readily available in King's other books, which makes you wonder why they appear here. The lengthy introduction to Night Shift, the short story The Ballad of the Flexible Bullet from Skeleton Crew, and the introduction to Secret Window, Secret Garden from Four Past Midnight. The space would have been better utilized to reprint unpublished pieces or interviews on King talking about writing. Perhaps the next time around, and there's plenty of pieces yet to be reprinted, King will find a capable editor who can do a better job. Am I saying you shouldn't buy the book? No, I'm not. Buy it because it does have some pieces that are otherwise difficult to find, but skim the outdated pieces and give your full attention to the set pieces, On Becoming a Brand Name, reprinted from Fear Itself, and the two talks he gave to library groups, including a long one for his Virginia Beach fans. I recommend the book, but wish it had been more rigorously edited. As is, it seems rushed and thrown together in a hurry to meet a deadline. Its contents are not carefully culled to serve up King's choicest tidbits of writing wisdom. 83. Dreamcatcher, 2001. Original title, Cancer. In the afternote to Dreamcatcher, Stephen King wrote that Tabitha used to call this novel the one about the shit weasels. It's certainly an unappealing subject, but as King told Time magazine, I'd never really read a story about something terrible happening revolving around bathroom functions, eliminatory functions. And I wanted to do that because it just occurred to me that so much of the really terrible news we get in our lives, we get in the bathroom. Either because we discover a lump, or because there's blood in our stool, or even when you look in the mirror and all at once you say, shit, man, I'm going bald. All those things happen in the bathroom. Half of really scaring people is getting them in a place that's undefended. Nobody's as defenseless as they are in the bathroom, with their pants down. Putting all that aside, what's left in the end is, as The Guardian pointed out, a novel that's slightly heavy going, but by no means a disappointment. King retains his crown. But it's not a favorite of King's, who in 2014 told Rolling Stone, I don't like Dreamcatcher very much. Written while under the influence of the painkiller OxyContin, Dreamcatcher was the first novel he wrote after the accident. Finding it difficult to sit up and type on his portable Mac, he wrote in longhand with a Waterman fountain pen. The ink, as well as the story, flowed out. Recalling it as four buddies from Derry, Maine come together for their annual hunting trip in the Maine woods, Dreamcatcher quickly moves from the mundane to the bizarre, straight out of Ripley's Believe It or Not. But the four lifelong friends are forced to believe the impossible when things go south in a hurry, and the hunters become the hunted. The Guardian said, Dreamcatcher falls squarely into the Baroque category, and will probably be most enjoyed by fans of The X-Files. The first surprise is that King makes explicit reference to his accident. One of his characters is hit by a car within the first few pages. In his afterword, King explains that several elements of his physical discomfort during the time of writing followed him into the narrative, and there is a painful, nightmarish quality to much of the action. It is a familiar device in King's fiction to have groups of characters united by a stand they have taken together in the past. Here it was a stand for good when they stopped a gang from bullying a child with mental difficulties. It is not until much later in the novel that the men realize exactly how this good deed has changed their lives. In short, Dreamcatcher is a mid-range book for King. It's fun, entertaining reading, but it does show the debilitating effects of writing while taking painkillers, as well as how King persevered to pull a novel out of his imagination despite his physical and medicinal handicaps.
84. Black House with Peter Straub, 2001. I remember working on the end of Black House, the book I wrote with Peter Straub, and coming to a scene where one of the characters is talking about never being able to go back to this plane of existence, American life in the year 2001 or 2002, because this person would sicken and die if that happened. And I was thinking that it was an elegant way to describe where I was coming from at that time. I was in pain a lot of the time. But when I was writing, I felt fine because I would be wherever you go when you're making these things up. When I go there, I'm not physically aware of my body very much. And I was thinking, this is a pretty good analog to the creative state. It's a place where you can go and feel well. Stephen King, Paris Review, Fall 2006. When I think about The Dark Tower and all King's fiction publications that tie into it, I don't think of individual small paintings, but one large canvas that remains unfinished, because he's always adding to it. It's a weave world, to borrow the title of a Clive Barker novel, in which numerous threads are intricately interwoven. Black House is another part of the large canvas known as The Dark Tower. Black House, a sequel to The Talisman, takes Jack Sawyer on another journey. At first glance, it's a journey set in this world, but that soon proves to be illusory. A former police detective for the LAPD, Jack comes out of retirement at the behest of a small-town police department in Wisconsin, beset by a serial killer named The Fisherman. What Jack finds is more than simply the work of a deranged serial killer intent on killing and cannibalizing children. He finds his way back into the world of the Dark Tower through the Black House, where he's once again challenged by unimaginable and formidable forces. Michael Collings, who admired The Talisman, puts the Black House in proper perspective, explaining that it is not a commercially driven sequel. It is, in fact, the linchpin narrative bringing together explicitly, undeniably, and utterly the mythic worlds King and Straub have drawn, pulling them together and knotting them at the core, providing for them, as had the original Talisman itself, a nexus for all possible worlds. Implicit in Black House are Straub's signal accomplishments in novels as diverse as Ghost Story, Shadowlands, Floating Dragon, and the Blue Rose trilogy. Black House fits seamlessly into the themes, the structures, and the styles of those books, those worlds, and expands upon them to give us a glimpse of a unity underlying Straub's fictions. Even more explicitly, it links most of King's major work over the past decade and looks directly forward to what may turn out to be the capstone work of his remarkable career, the completion of The Dark Tower. Collings concludes, For anyone interested in either King or Straub, and particularly for readers caught in the wonder of the Dark Tower, Black House is a must. 85. The Ultimate Stephen King Horror Story. Retirement? I'm done. Done writing books. Stephen King, Los Angeles Times. When Stephen King speaks, the media listens. In January 2002, he told the Los Angeles Times that he was finally calling it quits after collecting the stories for Everything's Eventual, the novel From a Buick 8, and completing the Dark Tower series. Then that's it. I'm done. Done writing books. You get to a point where you get to the edges of a room and you can go back and go where you've been and basically recycle stuff. I've seen it in my own work. People, when they read Buick 8, are going to think, Christine, it's about a car that's not normal, okay? You say, I've said the things that I have to say that are new and fresh and interesting to people. Then you have a choice. You can either continue to go on or say I left when I was still on top of my game. I left when I was still holding the ball instead of it holding me. In case people didn't get the message, the cover story for the September 27, 2002 issue of Entertainment Weekly shouted it. Exclusive. Stephen King calls it quits. America's most popular author tells us why he's written his last book. It's the one horror story King fans don't want to read. But some were properly skeptical, including his publisher at Scribner, Susan Moldau. In a phone interview with King's hometown newspaper, she said, "That rumor is older than Methuselah. And yet he keeps writing and publishing. I've heard him describe a novel that I know he wants to write that isn't a part of the Dark Tower series, and that doesn't seem to duplicate anything he's done before. And since he's described it to me, it would be harsh and cruel for him to withhold it from me." The Onion, on October 2, 2002, irreverently answered the question, how does the King of Horror plan to spend his retirement? Devote more time to getting rammed by vans. Trim front yard hedges under alias of Richard Bachman. Learn how to build ship in a bottle, make thousands of them. Finally get around to cleaning out that back room where for years he'd been throwing shopping bags full of cash. Spend more time terrifying family. Walk slowly down basement steps, each step creaking ominously as he descends into the darkness to grab the weed whacker. Hits his boneless leg over and over with hammer. Rid flower garden of woodchucks in most disturbing way possible. Scream, "No, no, never again," at the typewriter for 6 hours a day. Years later, King recanted, explaining, "When I said to that lady from the LA Times I might retire, I was still recovering from the accident that I was in. I was in a lot of pain, and I was under the pressure of finishing the Dark Tower. At that point, retirement looked good. When the pain went away and the Dark Tower finished up, retirement started to look bad." For King fans, it proved to be a false alarm. Next time, Mr. King, how about not scaring us? 86. From A Buick 8, 2002. For just cause, Stephen King hates to fly. Back in the day when he flew commercial, sitting in the first class section, it meant being hit on for autographs and having unwanted conversations. Later, when King leased commercial private jets out of Bangor International, he got the privacy he wanted. But on one Learjet flight, the air turbulence was so bad that King, strapped into the seat, fell to the ground when the seat was torn free. He was sitting sideways on the floor, strapped in, as the multi-million-dollar jet was shaken like a toy plane. That hair-raising experience goes a long way toward explaining why King has a fear of flying. In a dedication to Four Past Midnight, he wrote, "This is for Joe King, another white-knuckle flyer. He prefers to drive, and when he's not listening to audiobooks on CD, he's wool-gathering, mentally mulling over story ideas. It's also an opportunity for King to get off the road and plant himself on a stool at Waffle House to enjoy a cup of coffee, a plate of waffles, and eggs with cheese. Plain food for plain folks. He's also known to pull into rest stops and raid the vending machines for a typical Steve King health meal, a soda and a candy bar, as he wrote in his afterword to Full Dark, No Stars. Though King always adds extensive notes to the short fiction collections, he rarely does so for novels, on the assumption, so common for writers, that a novel must speak for itself. I think a lot of his readers are interested in whatever he has to say about his work, be it short or long fiction. It's an opportunity for the author to speak his mind, to share his thoughts on a novel's creation. In the author's note to From a Buick 8, King explains its genesis. I had a truckload of furnishings, books, guitars, computer components, clothes, and paper. My second or third day on the road found me in western Pennsylvania. I needed gas and got off the turnpike at a rural exit. He went to the restroom to take a leak, and afterward, when checking out what was behind the station, he slipped 10 feet down its steep grade, checking himself by grabbing onto a random something. Had he continued the downward slide into the creek, how long, he mused, would it have been before the attendants at the gas station noticed he was missing? How long before they'd have found me if I had drowned? The story is set in Pennsylvania, which is where King took his tumble. Its texture can be attributed to the face time he spent with state troopers who shared their war stories, which gives the novel its verisimilitude. Drawn from a Bob Dylan song, the story centers on a 1953 Buick Roadmaster stored in a shed near the state trooper's barracks. As with the malevolent car Christine, this Buick is also not what it seems. And on that note, I should say no more, lest I give away too much about the plot. The point of the novel, though, is really not the mysterious car that came from who knows where. The novel, wrote Andrew O'Hare for Salon, is that we don't get any answers to the big questions. Strange things happen, and more often than not, they can't be explained. Life ends in death, and more often than not, it's a horrible, wrenching experience, at least for those of us left behind. Where have the dead gone? We don't know. But from here, it looks dark and far away. The big questions, as O'Hare said, have come to the forefront in King's fiction. But on those, he can only speculate. Like the rest of us, he cannot know. In the end, the book is a fun, fast read and belongs right next to Christine on the bookshelf. Christine, after all, is a haunted car, and the Buick 8 in this novel is haunted, but in a different, stranger way. The novel, said Publishers Weekly in its review, isn't major King, but it's nearly flawless and one terrific entertainment. Fasten your seatbelt and enjoy the ride. 87. Stephen King receives the National Book Award. I'd like to win the National Book Award, the Pulitzer Prize, the Nobel Prize. I'd like to have someone write a New York Times book review piece that says, "Hey, wait a minute, guys, we made a mistake. This guy is one of the great writers of the 20th century." But it's not going to happen for two reasons. One is I'm not the greatest writer of the 20th century, and the other is that once you sell a certain number of books, the people who think about literature stop thinking about you and assume that any writer who is popular across a wide spectrum has nothing to say. The unspoken postulate is that intelligence is rare. It's clear in the critical stance. I hear it in the voices of people from the literary journals where somebody will start by saying, "I don't lower myself." But the fact is that intelligence is fairly common. What's rare is education. Or it used to be. Stephen King, Publishers Weekly, January 24, 1991. National Book Foundation Press Release, September 15, 2003. The board of directors of the National Book Foundation today announced that its 2003 Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters will be conferred upon Stephen King, one of the nation's most popular, imaginative, and well-loved authors. Mr. King has published more than 200 short stories, including the O. Henry Award-winning The Man in the Black Suit, and 40 books during a career spanning three decades. He has earned the reputation among readers and book lovers as a genre-defying stylist, vivid storyteller, and master of suspense. The medal will be presented to Mr. King on Wednesday evening, November 19th, at the 54th National Book Awards Ceremony and Benefit Dinner at the New York Marriott Marquis Hotel in Times Square. Mr. King will deliver a keynote address to an audience of more than 1,000 authors, editors, publishers, friends, and supporters of books and book publishing. The evening benefits the National Book Foundation's many educational outreach programs for readers and writers across the country. The annual award was created in 1988 by the Foundation's Board of Directors to celebrate an American author who has enriched the literary landscape through a lifetime of service or body of work. The previous recipients are Jason Epstein, Daniel Boorstin, Saul Bellow, Eudora Welty, James Laughlin, Clifton Fadiman, Gwendolyn Brooks, David McCullough, Toni Morrison, Studs Terkel, John Updike, Ray Bradbury, Arthur Miller, and Philip Roth. In making the announcement on behalf of the Board of Directors, Neil Baldwin, Executive Director of the Foundation, said, "Stephen King's writing is securely rooted in the great American tradition that glorifies spirit of place and the abiding power of narrative. He crafts stylish, mind-bending page-turners that contain profound moral truths, some beautiful, some harrowing, about our inner lives. This award commemorates Mr. King's well-earned place of distinction in the wide world of readers and book lovers of all ages. Mr. King will receive $10,000 along with the medal. This is probably the most exciting thing to happen to me in my career as a writer since the sale of my first book in 1973, Mr. King said. I'll return the cash award to the National Book Foundation for the support of their many educational and literary outreach programs for children and youth across the country. The medal I will keep and treasure for the rest of my life." 88. Take Stephen King seriously. I never felt a conflict in my own soul between popular fiction and so-called literary fiction. When I sit down at the word processor, I just do what I do. I am always disappointed, however, when my work or another writer's work is relentlessly ghettoized by people who would protest vehemently if blacks were excluded from their local country club. Stephen King, The Book Review, AOL, November 1997. On one side of the bridge is popular fiction, and on the other, literary fiction. And never the twain will meet. The unbridgeability of the two is an elitist view that Stephen King adamantly rejects. In college, King was frustrated at the faculty members in the English department who had no time for popular culture, until King, an undergraduate, suggested a college course on the topic and offered to teach it. He did so with a front man. It was the only time at the University of Maine at Orno that an undergraduate taught a class. Like Rodney Dangerfield, whose famous line was, "I don't get no respect," popular fiction has always been dissed and dismissed. As King told Publishers Weekly in January 1977, "Everyone should study James M. Cain in writing class instead of the marsh gas they put out for us to admire. What's admired and celebrated by the National Book Awards is literature, the kind written by Shirley Hazard, who won the award for fiction the same year King got an award for his contribution to American letters." Hazard, born in 1931, is clearly a card-carrying member of the literati. She's won several notable literary awards, including a National Book Award for fiction for The Great Fire. When asked if she had ever read a Stephen King novel, she told the Associated Press, "I just haven't had time to get around to one." She further explained that she's too busy reading Shakespeare and Joseph Conrad. It's not likely she'll ever find time to read a Stephen King novel. Moreover, she doesn't endorse King's suggested list of popular culture novels. I don't think giving us a reading list of those who are most read at this moment is much of a satisfaction, she said. As Stephen King likes to say, "Oh man, who farted?" The popularity of King and his fellow best-selling writers is a sore point with the literati, who once commanded book advances disproportionately large in contrast to their net sales. In short, the literati saw pop writers as overpaid interlopers, hogging the limelight in terms of media attention and book sales. Moreover, they contended, pop writers were inferior craftspeople when compared to their own work. But the fact remained that the best-selling books subsidized the literary books. The inevitable sea change came when investors and their corporate bean counters weighed in, took control of the sinking publishing ships, and decided it was time for all authors to fish or cut bait. In the end, it was all about the lucrative catch, the bounty they brought in. What most people present at the ceremony didn't know was that King had almost killed himself to make an appearance to accept his award. Sick with pneumonia in his right lung, King spent Thanksgiving recovering at a main hospital. As Warren Silver, his lawyer and spokesman, explained, he had been walking around with it, and it got worse and worse. King was so proud of being the recipient of an award that he had spent $60,000 for 5 tables for family and friends. This was his moment to shine, and he took advantage of it. He wanted to share the moment with his nearest and dearest. The full text of King's acceptance speech is free online, nationalbook.org. It's also available as a downloadable audio file from Amazon, Building Bridges, Stephen King Live at the National Book Awards. Not surprisingly, his acceptance speech is a love letter to his wife, whom he credited in large part for her role in supporting him over the years, when encouragement was sparse. Tabitha kept the faith, and kept him going when he was plagued with self-doubt and, at times, writer's block. Stephen King graciously ended his 2003 acceptance speech. "I want to salute all the nominees in the 4 categories that are up for consideration, and I do. I hope you'll find something to read that will fill you up as this evening filled me up. Thank you." The literati strikes back. Like the stormtroopers in Star Wars hastily putting on body armor and digging in to take offensive positions, when the Committee for the National Book Awards sent out a press release announcing King as a recipient, the literati began their war of words. In an article by Orlando Sentinel book critic Nancy Pate, November 19, 2003, on the day King accepted his award, critics nationwide chimed in unison. Harold Bloom, quoted in the New York Times, said of King that he is a man who writes what used to be called penny dreadfuls. That they could believe that there is any literary value there, or any aesthetic accomplishment, or signs of an inventive intelligence, is simply a testimony to their own idiocy. J. Peter Zane, book review editor of the North Carolina Raleigh News and Observer. There's nothing wrong with being elitist when you're talking about literary standards. Stephen King receiving a literary award is just another sign that we don't take books and culture seriously. We're equating arts and culture with entertainment. I don't think King being honored by the National Book Awards is a good thing. Dennis Lloyd Johnson of Melville House, a small press. There appears to be some confusion. No, King's not getting the National Book Award. But there's still a big difference from when Oprah got the award for promoting readership. He's an entertainer. Giving Stephen King the award is not as bad as giving Henry Kissinger the Nobel Peace Prize, but it's right up there. Being literary is not being elitist. It's just being literary. And if anyone is elitist, it's the National Book Awards because they're so expensive. 89. Everything's Eventual, 2002. King says he has always wanted to build a bridge between wide popularity and a critical acceptance. But my taste is too low. There is a broad streak of the vulgate, not the vulgar, in my stuff. But that is the limitation of my background, and one of my limitations as a writer. I've got a lot of great things out of a small amount of talent. Stephen King, Publishers Weekly, January 24, 1991. By conventional rules, when compiling an anthology, the lead story should be the strongest in the collection and the final piece the second strongest. In the case of Everything's Eventual, the lead story should have been The Man in the Black Suit, and the final story should have been The Little Sisters of Illyria, with its thematic suggestion that there are many open roads yet to explore. This time, though, King used a pack of cards to determine the arrangement of the stories. No matter. Consider the arrangement, then, like a box of chocolates without the cheat sheet telling you what's in each piece. Take a chance, this collection suggests, and you'll find most, if not all, of them tasty. Go ahead. Take a bite. If you're pressed for time, though, read The Man in the Black Suit. One of three stories in this book, drawn from the pages of The New Yorker, The Man in the Black Suit won the World Fantasy Award and also the O. Henry Award for Best Short Fiction. Prize Stories, 1996, The O. Henry Awards, edited by William Abrahams. What levels the playing field is that all the stories for Prize Stories are blind submissions. They are judged on their own merits. When Stephen King won its top prize, it took a lot of people by surprise. As Megan Harlan of Entertainment Weekly, May 10, 1996, wrote, Stephen King is the inexplicable winner of this year's prestigious O. Henry First Prize for a fair-to-middling psychological horror story. Perhaps this was a dry year for American short fiction writers. Clearly not, as the 19 other stories included are overall rich and eclectic. Harlan wasn't alone in dissing King's contribution. Publishers Weekly called it one of the weaker stories in this year's collection. The story had its origin in a conversation with a friend, whose grandfather claims to have had a face-to-face encounter with Satan himself. King took that idea and wrote the story, which he said in interviews is a homage to a Nathaniel Hawthorne story, Young Goodman Brown, published in 1835. The weakest story in Everything's Eventual is In the Death Room. Meant to be a serious story, it unfortunately reads like a parody. Held prisoner in a death room south of the border, an American journalist enduring an interrogation manages to escape because his hands were not secured. A big mistake that no professional would make. It's a lackluster story that goes for the gross out, with cartoony characters straight out of bad pulp fiction. But anthologies aren't graded on their worst stories. They're assessed on their best stories. And along with The Man in the Black Suit, a short story from King's Dark Tower story cycle is compelling reading. The Little Sisters of Illyria strikes all the right notes and can be read as a standalone story, though it's obviously part of a much larger work in progress, the tapestry that is the Dark Tower series. On that note, I strongly urge you to check out eBay and Abe Books, since no trade edition from Scribner exists of Little Sisters of Illyria, which includes the revised first novel in the Dark Tower series, The Gunslinger. This gorgeous Donald M. Grant edition also sports illustrations by Michael Whalen, which alone is worth the price of admission. This collection, as People magazine points out, is an eclectic but finely balanced group. There are some pieces that could even be called uplifting, and one, 1408, that provides an almost perfect glimpse into madness. Anyone who appreciates a good yarn, especially those for whom a little King goes a long way, should give Everything's Eventual a turn. 90. Faithful. 2004. I'm always bummed out on the day baseball goes back into hibernation. Stephen King, Twitter, October 30th, 2014. Directly behind the King's home in Bangor is a state-of-the-art ballpark. It was a gift to the city from its most famous residents, who dug deep into their pockets to pay $1.5 million for its construction. No one would have complained if, like other donors, the park had been named in their honor, but that's not the King's style. The ballpark is named the Sean T. Mansfield Stadium, after the late son of Dave Mansfield, who coached a Little League team that made it all the way to the Maine State Championship. Sean, who suffered from cerebral palsy, died in 1980. He was only 14 years old. A plaque at the entrance to the ballpark states that it's dedicated to Sean Trevor Mansfield and all the other boys who never got to play baseball. The year that the Bangor Little League team went on to win the state championship, Stephen King's son, Owen, was on the team, and Stephen, who was an assistant coach, was surprised at the poor state of the field. When the season was over, he decided to do something about it. I thought to myself, what a shame it is that children have to make adjustments on substandard fields with shoddy equipment. It's not on par with world peace or ending hunger here in Bangor, but I was taught that charity begins at home, he told Ryan R. Robbins, BangorInfo.com, 1992. The baseball park is now one of the most actively used facilities in the Queen City. King and baseball go back a long way. Even before he was drafted to write about sports in high school for a local newspaper, King, who grew up without a father, found that baseball filled a need in him. Even as a 9-year-old child, he watched with rapt attention the 1956 World Series on a black-and-white television. Baseball has saved my life, he told Bob Haskell in The Complete Handbook of Baseball, 1992. Every time I needed a lifeline, baseball was it. I grew up alone. My mother worked. I was a latchkey kid before anyone knew what that was. I would watch baseball when I got home from school. I listened to the games on the radio before that. Unlike other small boys who played catch with their fathers in the backyard or sat next to them at baseball games or played Little League baseball with their fathers watching from the bleachers, King missed out because, as the saying went in their small family, Daddy done gone. But baseball remained. King became a lifelong fan, and the game still plays an integral part of his life. Clearing the bases. Life, as King has said, has a funny way of coming around full circle, and so it has with King's writings about baseball. From Head Down, his insightful diary turned article about Little League baseball published in The New Yorker, 1990, to a book about the Red Sox titled Faithful, co-written with novelist Stuart Onan, King has rounded the bases all the way to home plate. Head Down is the story of how Bangor West, a Little League team, made it all the way to the state championship and won. Faithful is the story of how the Red Sox made it all the way to the World Series in 2004 and won, their first in 86 years. But King, who frequently employs baseball metaphors when explaining his own writing career, usually strikes out with literary critics who summarily dismissed his fiction. The ones who published in such tony magazines as The New Yorker and in literary journals where the bona fides often mentioned grant support, which infuriated King when he was a struggling writer who didn't have resources to fall back on. But when Stephen King published Head Down in the April 16, 1990 issue of The New Yorker, it signaled a sea change. King was establishing himself on their home turf, and the critics could no longer ignore him. I can't help imagining some of those highfalutin literary writers sitting down at the breakfast table with scones and coffee and opening up that issue, only to find King's lengthy contributions staring them right in the face. The writer who said his work was the equivalent of a Big Mac and large fries had created literary cordon bleu. He had published in their magazine, and the evidence stared them in the face. King can write. In baseball terms, it was a whole new ball game. Make no mistake,
Stephen King was clearly in a league of his own. He could write for the masses and for the literary crowd as well. He had, in effect, built a bridge from pop culture to literature, which he had been working toward since his college days. The two, he suggested, could coexist. They were brothers separated at birth and shared a common heritage. Storytelling. Head Down is a fine piece of nonfiction writing. As an assistant coach for the team, Stephen King had a great view from the sidelines. He chronicled the young boys' hopes and dreams as they triumphed over their counterparts. On August 5, 1989, in an 11-8 victory, Bangor West won the Maine State Little League Championship. In the movie A League of Their Own, actor Tom Hanks famously said, "There's no crying in baseball." Well, it may be true of pro baseball, but not so in Little League, where the young boys wear their hearts on their sleeves. As King recounted in Head Down at the 1989 Little League Championship game, when the pitcher of the team that lost to Bangor West realized in the final moments that they were going to lose, he begins to weep. The essay was reprinted as the final piece in King's 816-page anthology, Nightmares and Dreamscapes. The audiobook for Head Down was read by Stephen King. It's no surprise that baseball metaphors sprinkle King's conversation in interviews, in his nonfiction, and especially in his fiction. Baseball reference, in fact, can be found in several of King's fiction works. A Sandy Koufax baseball card in Needful Things that is prominent in the plot, and the key figure of Tom Gordon in The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. King also published a short book, Blockade Billy, about a promising young ball player from the game's old days named William Blakely, whose career crashed and burned. I love old-school baseball, and I also love the way people who've spent a lifetime in the game talk about the game, said King, talking about the book. But if you want to talk about King, baseball, and enduring love, you gotta talk about the Boston Red Sox. You gotta. Semper Fidelis. On December 6th, 2014, tickets for the Red Sox spring training games went on sale. The prices ranged from $5 for a lawn seat to $48 for a home plate dugout box. There were 18 home exhibition games played at JetBlue Park Stadium at 11500 Fenway South Drive in Fort Myers, Florida. And my guess is that there was a tall man with square-framed wire glasses wearing a ball cap and a t-shirt who either was holding a book to read between innings or a notebook in which to write. That man would be Stephen King, who makes his winter home in nearby Sarasota. Just so you know, he's not there to sign autographs, and he's not there to give you advice on how to get published or how to get an agent. He's there, just like you, to watch his favorite baseball team practice before it moves back north to its real home in Boston in Fenway Park, where hope springs eternal. The team won the World Series in 2004, and fans want to see a repeat, and a three-peat, and, well, you get the idea. The weather's always warm in Fort Myers. I've spent my fair share of time there because my mother-in-law made a permanent move down from Delaware to the City of Palms, as it's called. When Maine's getting hit with massive snowstorms that intimidate snowplows, sitting on a bleacher in sunny Fort Myers and watching your favorite baseball team under a clear blue sky, feeling a light breeze with the temperature in the high 70s, holding a cold brewski in one hand and a juicy hot dog slathered with condiments in the other. Well, life doesn't get much better than that. It's a time when the Red Sox are working out the kinks, shaking off the winter doldrums before things get serious, really serious, when they get back to Fenway, which comes alive every spring with a packed crowd cheering on the home team as they take to the field. In the bleachers at Fenway, you'll find Stephen King. Sometimes he's alone, and sometimes he's with a friend. But he's always got a book to read and a notebook for the downtimes during the game. He sometimes fills that notebook with fiction, which will get transcribed by an assistant when he gets back to Bangor,
a 3-hour, 40-minute drive. King is a permanent fixture at the games. He's even thrown out the first ball of the season, but that doesn't mean he's public property, which acquisitive fans soon find out. He absolutely doesn't sign for graphers, a term his daughter Naomi employed in an article she wrote for Castle Rock, because this is his personal time. He's just a baseball fan who happens to be a guy named Stephen King. In other words, save yourself some trouble and disappointment and don't play the role of a demanding fan. If you want to show your appreciation, give him what he wants. Let him enjoy the game in peace, just as you'd want to do, too. King may not mind if people come up and talk baseball. That's what they're all there for, after all. But if you ask his thoughts on how the team is going to do that year, you get his stock answer. I'm not an expert. I'm just a fan, and I don't know. I'm hoping for the best, just like you are. He told NPR's Michelle Norris that's what he tells everyone who asks. It's short, it's quick, and it satisfies the fan who wants to be able to go home and tell the wife, "Guess what, honey? I saw Stephen King at the game, and I talked to him for a minute." How big is Stephen King? And how big a fan is Stephen King? Big enough on both counts that when the Red Sox published a retrospective, Fenway Park, 100 years, they turned to, you guessed it, Stephen King to write an introduction, and he obliged. It's a $75 book, and according to the team's official website, in short supply and available nowhere else, so get it while you can. About Faithful, two diehard Boston Red Sox fans chronicle the historic 2004 season. As far as writers go, Stuart and I were the two luckiest sons of bitches alive. Events conspired to even make it an uplifting book. Thanks to the Red Sox, it even has a beginning, a middle, and an end, said Stephen King in an audiophile interview on Stuart Onan's and his good fortune to write a book about the Red Sox during the season the team won the World Series. If you take a gander at the spine of the first printing of Stuart Onan's novel, The Speed Queen, you'll notice something odd. There's a white bar running down its length, with black text overprinted. The Speed Queen, Stuart Onan, Doubleday. What's underneath that white bar is Dear Stephen King, the original title, which King hated, spurring his lawyers in action. Obviously, by the time Doubleday got the legal complaint, it was too late to stop the presses. Either the books had already been printed and bound, or the cover boards, in black, had already been printed. Regardless, the publisher was forced to go back and overprint. I loved the book, hated the title. I felt he was using me, King told Audiophile. In Necessary Evil, an original article written for Phantasmagoria, a King zine, Stuart Onan explained, The Speed Queen, Dear Stephen King, by any name, the book is a hot, funny, sexy, wild ride. It's fast as hell, and I think the voice is the best I've done. Go to the work and you'll see. The legal entanglements aside, good writers admire good writing. And King saw that Onan had the goods. They also shared something else in common. They are both Red Sox fans, and in time became fast friends that collaborated on a nonfiction book titled Faithful, a chronicle of the 2004 season in which the Red Sox won the World Series. In King's essay, in the back part of the book, he paints a word picture. It may still be March in the Northeast, with air as raw as hamburger and snow up to David Ortiz's belt buckle, but as the Boston Red Sox take the field against the St. Louis Cardinals, here on the afternoon of March 16th for a World Series rematch, it feels like midsummer in Florida. The sunshine is hazy, the temperature is a humid 80 degrees, and the clouds over the Gulf of Mexico promise thunderstorms later. King's piece largely discusses his thoughts on the question posed to him from a Rhode Island newspaper reporter, in response to which he says, I cunningly answer, I don't know, because I want to answer it here and get paid for it. If you want to find out what the question is and pay King for it, buy the book.
I ain't gonna tell you. But what I will tell you is that Faithful is a 445-page love letter to King's favorite baseball team, and as such, it's worth reading. Think about it. In Faithful, we read how the Red Sox went on to win the World Series, even though they hadn't won one in nearly 9 decades. You can't ask for a better ending to a book. That's life. That's baseball. And this time, in the big leagues, there was no need for crying. Unless you're a Cardinals fan. Not in my lifetime, not in yours either. In Shawshank Redemption, Andy Dufresne says, "Remember, Red, hope is a good thing, maybe the best of things, and no good thing ever dies." The same can be said of the Red Sox legion of fans who are true believers at the start of every season, hoping to see their team get to the World Series and, once again, win. Michelle Norris of NPR interviewed King for Stephen King on Baseball's Spring Training. It aired on March 16, 2005. In the piece, King explains that before the miraculous 2004 season, he despaired of ever seeing his team win a world championship, hence the words he figured would be engraved on his tombstone. Not in my lifetime, not in yours either. King now has to pick different words for his tombstone. As Norris explains, for Stephen King, the Red Sox are an addiction, not merely a passion. "I generally find a way to finagle tickets, although I have to tell you this year has been an extremely tough get as far as Red Sox tickets go," said King. "The feeling is one of possibility, endless possibility.